Welcome to another edition of I Like Films. This is me, Jonathan Ross, and this week I'm thrilled to say I'm spending some time with someone who I think I can consider a friend. I hope I can consider a friend. Joe Cornish, who you will know, initially from his work with Adam Buxton. Adam and Joe's show was great on Channel 4, and of course then their radio show, which has taken on near legendary status. But Joe, of course, is a director now. Attack the Blocks, I thought, was an amazing film. I loved it, and I watched it again this week just to refresh my memory and enjoyed it just as much as the first time. He has a new movie out, The Kid Who Will Be King, and he's here with me now. Joe, thank you so much for giving me time and coming to my office as well.
Thanks for having me. It's lovely to be here.
Finally, and this is what I guess you're dealing with, and it must be slightly, I don't know if it's annoying, but it must be sort of a bit wearisome, is people are going on about how long it took you to make a second film. I adored Attack the Block, and you know
Thank
that.
You.
And I watched it again yesterday, and it stands up brilliantly.
Oh, good.
It's fabulous. So I love that. And everyone's thinking, when's Joe Cornish? He's great. Joe Cornish can direct. He can write.
Come on, Cornish.
Come on, Cornish. Finish.
Pull your finger out.
And how many years was it?
It's a year. But it's a year that lasted 7 years.
It's a weird astrological
phenomenon.
So why?
Well, you say Attack the Block was very successful. It actually it wasn't successful box office-wise. And then it took a while to catch on. And then what happened is I had been writing Ant-Man with Edgar Wright long before Attack the Block. So I went straight from publicizing Attack the Block into writing Ant-Man. And, you know, we wrote that on and off. In fact, not even on and off, just on, till 2014.
So that was a long chunk of time.
Yeah, and I didn't really feel I could bugger off and make a film. And I didn't really feel ready to bugger off and make a film. I was offered lots of big franchises, but I felt a bit nervous about being crushed by the wheels of industry, in the words of Heaven 17.
Which kind of happened with Marvel.
It did a little bit, yeah. That was, you know, what happened with Ant-Man was a cautionary tale, and Edgar decided to leave because they wanted to rewrite it completely under us. And it happened very fast in a quite alarming way. And it was, you know, an example of, you know, the films cost a lot of money, and they... And you're very friendly while you work on them, as you know, but there are times when just the scale of the enterprise kicks in and it's no longer about being friendly or personalities. It's just, this is what's got to be done.
There's a fear, I guess.
The thing with Ant-Man was the studio changed completely from when we first... I mean, when Edgar and I first pitched that idea, all the rights to the Marvel comics were owned by Artisan.
Right.
Do you remember? And Artisan had a massive success with Blair Witch. And they wanted to try and revitalize the Marvel catalogue. So that was super early. That was about 2000.
So that was before Marvel had their own wing. It's before Disney bought Marvel.
Oh, way before Disney bought Marvel. So we were part of that, the evolution of that company. Or not part of it, but just witnesses to it.
Yeah.
And involved in it since... Like, our first proper meeting on Ant-Man was just as Jon Favreau was... We went to Lucasfilm, you know, in Marin County, and we sat in that amazing cinema they've got there with Jon Favreau watching his locked cut of Iron Man. So that was when Marvel was still employing these kind of esoteric kind of author directors
before they
to try and bring credibility to their...
But,
to their catalogue.
But what I find so weird about that experience, because you weren't going to direct, Edgar was going to direct.
Okay? Yeah.
And Edgar, you know what you're going to get. As soon as you sign Edgar, it's not like he changed over a few years
But back then, that's what they wanted.
Of course.
They wanted directors with vision to come and bring credibility to their
But I'm still amazed that they didn't pull the trigger on your version, because they did the same kind of thing. They went out there with Guardians of the Galaxy, and they used James Gunn, who is not dissimilar his past history.
Well, you know, something else happened, which is there was something called the Marvel Creative Committee. So Kevin Feige didn't really have complete authority back then. There was something called the Marvel Creative Committee that was a group of big business dudes, some of whom didn't have that much to do with filmmaking, who controlled the intellectual property. And I think every decision had to go through them at that point. And simultaneous to what happened with Ant-Man was a struggle between different levels of management.
There's so much that goes on behind the scenes in filmmaking. And it's like, I know the more, you know, when I first started being a reviewer, I used to go, this film is terrible. And as you get a little bit more aware of the truth of the business, you begin to become, you're certainly a lot more circumspect, but you become slightly more kind of generous. And you think, well, oh, I can see studio notes must have played a part there, and there must have been this. And you realise that just the massive level of compromise, which seems to rise on a par with the budget.
Absolutely. And you know what? I'm glad you're doing this podcast, because I miss you from the film reviewing Firmament because of your generosity. And I'm not just saying that to Brownnose. I am a little bit. But you were always, you're a film lover and you're passionate about it. And you were always, like, if you had a weakness, it was because you were passionate about things that were a bit rubbish.
Yeah, well,
but,
you say this.
But that in itself was really valuable, yeah. Because you love everything. And
I love everything, but I mean, there were some things. For example, are you a fan of The Favourite, the film that everyone's
I really enjoyed The Favourite,
okay.
Yeah.
I thought the direction, I hated his choice of lenses. That really disturbed me, took me out of the movie completely.
Now you're contradicting everything I just said.
Olivia Colman was amazing, but if you take away that central performance, I think you've got a kind of disposable Netflix movie.
I disagree. I liked it very much.
Obviously, you're wrong.
It swept me along. I love the sort of wide-angle lenses he used. I love the way the camera rushed into the rooms. I loved what she called Emma Stone, Sharon Stone's.
Sharon Stone was fantastic in it.
I loved the chickens. The rabbits.
Did you like the tangerine scene?
I love the tangerine scene.
I didn't like
scene.
The tangerine scene. I thought it was unnecessary.
A citrus fruit in movies, you know, wanking into an orange. Mm, no, a peach.
So that was another film.
Yeah.
All right, so Ant-Man didn't happen.
Yeah.
Snow Crash didn't happen. Various other projects you were connected to
didn't happen. Well, Snow Crash was always a long shot. It was, something for me to get my teeth into while I was working with Edgar. And it's an have you read that novel?
I have. Neil Stevenson.
It's an incredible novel. And it was always going to be a sort of Great White Hope. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like an impossible dream.
But you got close.
We did get close. I'm really proud of that script. I think it's a really good script, and we've changed it into a TV thing. So we've taken a different approach with it.
And you wouldn't direct that then, I guess. It's TV, or would you do it the first episode?
Maybe something like that.
Yeah.
There was Snow Crash. There was a project called Section 6, which was another brilliant script about the formation of MI6, a kind of proto-James Bond. Not entirely dissimilar to what Matthew Vaughan, I think, is working on now.
Oh, with his
sort of historical Bond. His is going to be much more, wacky.
More comic strip.
I think Section 6 was quite proper, like crunchy historical action adventure.
So, Joe, what is it that grabs you about an idea when you do it? You obviously love the book Snow Crash, but you look at what you've done there. It's very, very. There's no. It's not like there's one kind of consistent genre that you cling to here. You know, you do Attack the Block, which was so fresh, but it was very, very British. And it brought together your love of like sci-fi movies. It had an 80s feel, but also it was very of its time. It's very modern. Now we've got The Kid Who Would Be King, which is, it's modern, fresh, and uniquely yours. But it feels very much like you are paying back to the joy you had from watching movies in the 80s again. Snow Crash, very different. Sector 6, very different. So what is it that excites you about an idea when you get an idea in your vision?
I tend to picture an action sequence in my head, and then I think of a theme. So if you can think of an action sequence that's not about talking, that's about kinetics, and think, oh, well, I could make that actually advance some sort of a theme. So in Attack the Block, it was the idea of hoodies, so to speak, fighting aliens. I thought, okay, that's action, and you could say something metaphorically about the... In Kid Who Would Be King, it's the big action sequence with the kids forming an army...
In the school.
...defending their school like a medieval castle. I thought, okay, you can say something about... the state of the country and like the optimism of the kids and the threat of history recurring and stuff. Section 6 had these brilliant, incredible action sequences in Russia between the wars in these sort of island fortresses. Snow Crash had these action sequences you could do in virtual reality where you could mess around with the physics and the visuals. So we always try and think, well, what could you put on screen visually that would be, to use a pretentious phrase, pure cinema. Do you know what I mean?
So that's quite early in the process then. That's when you're beginning to mull the idea over and think about the shape of a script.
That's what usually makes it stick.
That's interesting. So you're very visual.
I suppose so. I like to think there's one key moment that I really cannot wait to put on screen.
And then when you are making the film, do you delay that gratification and say, let's put that back in the schedule, or do you have to get that out of the way first?
That just falls when it falls.
When it falls. So you're not greedy. Not selfish.
No. It's very pragmatic, isn't it, filmmaking? It's very logistical and systematic, and it's to do with so many different moving parts. You can't decide what you're going to do on what day, really.
Let's talk about the huge number of moving parts, because I was amazed. I mean, the visual effects that you have in The Kid Who Would Be King are terrific. They're wonderful. They're crucial to the film, of course. You couldn't make the film. But there's a lot of them. I mean, man, that is a big team you have assembled under you. For that, it must be one of the biggest visual effects teams.
One of the biggest films ever made. It must be one of the biggest films ever made. Well, yes, it is.
Yeah.
Not.
But the team, presumably there are lots of people there you've never even met. There must be names in those credits. You've never met that person. You've got no idea who that person is or what they actually did.
Right. That's true. There's a lot of credits on The Kid Who Would Be King. Massive.
So a major step towards a bigger scale of storytelling than Attack the Block.
That was sort of purposeful. That one of the things that made me cautious about taking a big franchise was that I wouldn't be able to handle the machine.
Because you offered Star Trek as well, weren't you?
I was. I took a couple of meetings about Star Trek with Bob Orsi and JJ. But yeah, part of the reason that made me step back from those things is that, well, if I don't understand the bits and bobs of how it works, how can I possibly have control over them? And there's going to be too many ways I can be subverted, or do you know what I mean?
So
I mean,
not to say
that sounds like I'm suspicious of the process, but I like to get my hands on everything. Do you know what I mean? That's what we used to do
of course.
The Adam and Joe show.
But it's also that's part of the reason why you want to make a film, which is your film, as opposed to just be a cog in the
I'm not a brilliant, for hire professional director man. Do you know what I mean? I have to author it, otherwise there's lots of other people that would be better at just executing someone else's script than me, I think.
So when
it's too much like hard work as well.
It's a big chunk of your life.
Yeah.
And you know what? One of the reasons why I've never directed is partly because I don't think it'd be any good, partly because no one's ever asked me, but mainly because it does seem like a lot of work and a lot of early mornings
it really
involved.
Is.
That must be off-putting.
Early mornings I enjoy now that I'm completely... I stopped years ago taking it, drinking or any inebriants. And when I was a younger man, I used to dread the mornings. I was like an 11 a.m. man.
You never used to get up with 11?
No.
You never saw 11? What are you talking about? I know you didn't get up before 1.
That is not strictly true. But
largely.
That would be my ambition, would be not to get up before 1. But we would work until like 4 in the morning on Adam and Joe. You're right. We would stuff wire coat hangers up teddy bears till the early hours. So we were very much night owls, but not anymore. And I really love it the other way around.
Let me ask you about when you decided you want to direct that, because it kind of surprised me, not in a bad way, but I remember seeing you, we were at Comic-Con, San Diego Comic-Con. We got together for breakfast and Edgar was there promoting something. I can't remember what it was. It wasn't World's End. It was before that even. So it might have been...
Right. It might have been Attack the Block. He was with me.
No, you hadn't brought out Attack the Block yet. You hadn't. Yeah. This was before then because you were filming
him. Was it the Marvel panel for Ant-Man?
I think it was the Marvel panel for Ant-Man. And you were there and I knew you'd been loosely involved. I didn't know how much you'd been involved at that stage because we'd sort of lost touch a little bit. But you were filming him and I thought you were doing like a vlog based on his experience there. And I don't know what happened to that footage because presumably that would have been included in the extras for Ant-Man. But you were sort of... And I thought, oh, this is weird. Maybe Joe wants to get
into... That might be Hot Fuzz.
Yeah, I think it was.
That was Hot Fuzz. And I was... Basically, Edgar said, look, come on the tour with us and we'll write Ant-Man and you can make a little video as well. We'll have fun. And we did not write any Ant-Man. I just ended up as a like, idiot videographer, a sort of Bez character.
Well, because it surprised me to see you in that role. Because I thought, with no disrespect to people who do that, it doesn't seem like the most creative...
Well, I was there under the auspices of working on Ant-Man, but the writing never happened.
But you had
I did have an amazingly good time.
Oh yeah, that was apparent.
Yeah,
not getting up any days. So you actually were getting up early, but at that stage, you had your eye on directing. And did Edgar act as a mentor to you anyway, or were there kind of tips?
No, Edgar was hugely important to giving me the confidence to do it. Because I'm one of these people that would write first acts, have ideas, draw posters, think of climaxes, think of bits and bobs, have a million things from when I was a child in my desk, half finished. And to see someone close to you see it through, get to the end, because writing's difficult, right? To see somebody construct a script from beginning to end, then refine it, who isn't a mysterious arm's length figure, who's actually someone you know, who falls over and gets tired, and you know what I mean, like a proper human being.
I mean, they're the two qualities I think of when I think of Edgar as well.
Falling over and getting tired.
That defines him.
But he just to see someone normal and human doing it, and also to be able to talk to them and say, oh, how'd you get over this bump? Was crucial to me actually getting something finished.
But what I very much like about you as a person is something I also like about Edgar as a person is there is a lack of vanity. I mean, obviously you take pride in your work, but there's a lack of vanity about what you've achieved. I remember talking to Edgar and he said fairly early on in his career, he was invited by Sam Raimi onto the set of Spider-Man. And Sam said, do you want to set up this next shot?
And he went, I was with him for that.
Yeah, it was like, and he said, no, because the pressure of doing this. And I thought, I'd have done it. I mean, because it wouldn't have bothered me. but that wasn't hubris on my part. So I could see that how seriously he takes it and how seriously you take it. But also there isn't the feeling like, okay, of course I can do this.
Yeah.
It's more like, okay, I want to do this.
No, he works very, very hard. And you can tell by looking at his stuff, there's nothing that isn't considered and reconsidered. And that's why if someone comes along at the 11th hour and says, oh, we want you to write this, shoot this version of the script, it's just not going to happen with Edgar.
You mentioned, you know, ideas knocking around for a while. Of course, Baby Driver was, I think, his first attempt at a script when he was young, but obviously he refined and brought it out to huge success. And I think Kidder Will Be King, this was an idea that you, probably one of your first ideas as a sort of cinematic scene, wouldn't it?
Yeah, when I was about 12 or 13, I saw E.T. for the first time, which really blew my tiny head off because I was
like the favourite, overweighted.
Do you reckon?
No, I love E.T., I'm joking.
Because some people, if you're a couple of years too old for E.T., it didn't get you. You could have fought. Because there was a big cynical movement about Spielberg at the time that he was saccharine. And,
yeah.
So it's possible just to not be on the right.
Oh, no, I am much older than you and I adored E.T. Yeah. And still do.
Yeah, me too. So I saw that and loved it. And I was like a year or so older than Henry Thomas, than the character in it. And then the same year, in that glorious period in the early 80s when VHS videos were uncertified and anybody could see anything, one night I rented Exorcist, Zombie Flesh Eaters, Alan Parker's Fame and John Borman's Excalibur.
Wow.
In those big puffy Warner Brothers VHS sleeves.
Did you watch them in one night?
Yeah, my friend Julian Parsons' house, yeah. Well, I think his parents had gone away, so we were, you know, renting illicit stuff. And holy fucking shit.
But that's all good stuff there, as opposed to a lot of the stuff that was available in those heady days of early kind of like local video stores. A lot of it was terrible. Had a great box, but would have been
terrible. A while to get terrible, didn't it? The very first flush, those early video shops, when they only had about 200 titles, a lot of it was prestige stuff, wasn't it?
I think
it?
We remember it differently because I think you obviously were younger than me. I'd obviously seen those movies. Most of those movies you mentioned, I'd seen at the cinema.
Right.
Okay. So I wasn't looking desperately for a copy of Excalibur.
Right.
And indeed, still don't particularly feel the urge to watch John Borman's marvellous misstep again.
That film is fantastic. I will not have it called a misstep.
It has some wonderful moments.
It's amazing.
But I was looking for Zombie Flesh Eaters. I was looking for Last House on the Left, which are good films as well. But, you know, so I think they were available. But there were, you know, and Driller Killer was...
Yes.
That was the kind of first wave of that.
Yeah,
bad movies that just got publicity for the wrong reason. So you had this idea then.
I saw those two movies and I was constantly trying to think of little high concept ideas in my tiny brain. And I thought someone should do a movie where a kid, British kid, a bit like Elliot, found the sword in the stone as a sort of narrative device. So I started drawing little images like the sword coming out of the bathtub I thought of very early on.
Which is a great moment in the film, and it's wonderful that survived.
That used to be my little company logo, my fantasy company logo when I was a kid.
Wow.
And I'd draw fake movie posters, and I'd come up with the taglines, and I'd come up with the casting block with all my favourite actors. And like all my favourite bands doing the music.
It's interesting you were spending your energy on that rather than writing a script.
Well, I'd do that as well.
All right.
I'd do that as well, but they just were... I didn't really know what a script looked like. They were more like, almost like plays. And none of them... I never finished any of them. They'd only get to like to page 30 or 40.
That is the crucial thing, isn't it? Just finish it. Even if it's bad, finish it and then rework
it. Yeah, persevere in any enterprise begun until the end. Oh. You've got to finish it. Yeah.
But it's hard.
It is hard. It really is hard, but it's so satisfying. And here's the thing for any aspiring writers out there, is just write anything to get to the end. Just write complete, you know, just anything. Even if you skip a scene, just write a line going, oh, and somehow they get to the chemist.
Right.
Sounds like a good film.
That sounds like Shaun of the Dead. Somehow they get to the pub.
But then just keep going, because as soon as you've got to an ending and you step back and see the shape of it, the other stuff will usually fall into place. It's like making a jigsaw or doing a crossword puzzle. Do you know what I mean? You leave a strip blank.
Yeah.
You just move on.
I thought you were going to say, put the pieces anywhere.
Well, they wouldn't usually
That's a
fit.
Different interpretation of that analogy.
That would just be nonsense.
Just bang them in with a hammer and then you can walk away from it.
That's your script writing methodology.
Oh, I've never even got that close to finishing one. But this is a great family film. And part of me when I was watching it, I thought, I wish I was seeing this with my kids when they were younger. Because we used to seek out stuff that felt fresh, felt imaginative, and often didn't find it to watch with them. But my daughter, who's now 27, she adored it. She turned around and went, that was awesome. So I think you've achieved it. But marketing is the huge issue with these films, isn't it? It's how do you get them out then? How do you get kids to, or young people to go and see it?
I just think that, you know, Hollywood's got extremely good at making movies for mass audiences. Everything's for everybody. Mm. So this is kind of a movie that was made in the spirit of a time when there were kids' movies about kids for kids. And, you know, that's a tougher proposition now, I think. But all that matters is that it's good, because the nice thing about movies is they last.
Yeah.
And there's many terrible movies that do brilliantly and many brilliant movies that do less than brilliantly. And it all comes out in the wash.
You know, it's interesting you say that, because for my own association with cinema, really, is that because of my wife, Jane, as you know, she writes movies, now she's working in television. But I remember when Stardust came out, they didn't really know how to market it, and it didn't do that well. Did okay. And now it's really loved and celebrated by people. Kick-Ass, when Kick-Ass first came out, really didn't do that well. That first weekend, really didn't do that well. And now, obviously, Kick-Ass 2 was monstrous. But Kick-Ass 1, which was the one that they worked on together, Matthew and Jane, that now has a real following and was a, can be seen as a fresh and very original note in that genre.
Yeah.
So it is important, you're right, that it gets out there and it survives.
Well, that's the nice thing about movies, isn't it? That they stand alone and they stick around. Shaun of the Dead didn't do brilliantly when it was first released. There's countless movies that you can that are now, you know, beloved that didn't set the box office on fire.
Let me talk about films which I think you enjoyed. It was hard to tell at the time, but you used to talk about strange films. For example, Remo, Unarmed and Dangerous.
Yes.
Now, this was a movie which I don't really see. I love the idea of it. Having watched it, I didn't really see the charm in it.
No, I think it's the film that we saw the day that school broke up. So Adam and I went to see it the day we finished school.
What, 82, 3, 4?
No, five, six, okay. Something like that. So that's why it holds a special place in our hearts. It's more about when we saw it and who we saw it with.
Who was the actor in that? Fred something, wasn't it?
Fred Savage. Williamson.
Fred Williamson.
Yeah.
Remo, Unarmed and Dangerous.
It's got a very good training sequence in it that we referenced for our Ant-Man script.
You know, I was watching something the other day and I thought this must be one of the first training... Oh, yeah, it was Rocky. I was watching the first Rocky movie. And I adore Stallone. And my love of Stallone was increased after hearing you guys talk very positively about Cobra and Over the Top.
Cobra.
I mean, that's a very pedantic moment there.
Yes. Well, that's why I'm here.
But you like those films. It's not just a kind of. You don't come to mock, do you? You actually do enjoy them.
Well, that was a weird time, wasn't it? In the 80s, those big testosterone fueled action movies. They were slightly satirical in and of themselves.
The canon years.
They were very over the top. But even the big Stallone hits and the big Schwarzenegger hits, Commando, Predator, Cobra,
Running Man.
Yeah, they had a sense of humor about themselves.
Yeah, they didn't take themselves seriously. That's interesting. Whereas now we do, let's call it, we've entered the Christopher Nolan age, where films, unless they have a kind of rather relentless grittiness about them, people think they can't be enjoyed and taken seriously.
Well, the turning point for those action movies, weirdly, was, in a positive way, was Die Hard. Because all the lead actors were very over the top until... That was what was so innovative about Bruce Willis, this blue-collar, normal guy coming into the action film scenario.
Yeah,
so it changed a bit in the... When was Die Hard? 88?
I think it might
changed
be before
that. Changed a bit in the late 80s. And then, now you're right. The current trend is to be super...
But you don't
grim.
Go for the darkness.
I don't know. I'm a comedian, so I can't take things that take themselves seriously seriously.
But Snow Crash would have taken itself seriously, presumably.
No, Snow Crash is a funny book.
Oh, right.
It's
so
very satirical. Right. Yeah, it's not overtly jokey, but it's got a streak of Verhoeven in it.
Paul Verhoeven. Now, there's a filmmaker we could talk about for some length of time. Some amazing movies and some kind of really not amazing movies.
Yeah, well, they're all interesting. I think with a really good director... Their not so successful stuff is often just as interesting as their successful stuff, you think?
Are you a Showgirls fan?
Well, we made a little toy movie of Showgirls for the Adam and Joe show, so I know it very well. It's a strange movie. It's cut in the UK. There's a scene in the US version, a rape scene, that changes its flavour.
Well, that's
slightly.
That's with the rock star Andrew something at the end, isn't it? Yeah.
And that's a bit like, oh.
Yeah, I think we saw it opening day. We were in Florida at the time.
Right.
And fortunately, we didn't take the children.
Yeah.
We had someone look after them, and we went to see it, and we came out feeling slightly like, that was great fun until the end. And then it became quite horrible.
It's got some amazing stuff in it.
Precise.
Some ridiculous dialogue. And it's done with such gusto, isn't it?
Yeah.
Like, there's no sense of shame in that movie on any level.
Kind of, I would happily watch it again, I think.
But he's incredible. RoboCop is incredible. Total Recall, did he do Total Recall?
He did do Total Recall.
That's pretty incredible.
I have a story about meeting him while he was filming Total Recall, if you'd enjoy it.
I would love it.
I was filming
Starship Troopers is the other one we should mention. When
Starship
we talk
Troopers
about him.
Is incredible. Yeah. I love it. Yeah. I was filming an incredibly strange film show on Mexican wrestling movies. So we were at the studio just outside of Mexico City. I'm trying to remember what it's called. It's a Mexican word, which even if I say it, I'll mispronounce it. But anyway, it's a big studio. And I was filming a piece to camera. And the idea was that I would be on one of the little carts that you ride around studios on, and pull up towards the camera, I'd be delivering the piece to camera, and pull up towards it, and then just finish it there. But what I hadn't realized was, as we were driving, when we stopped, if I turned it off, the cart made a lot of noise as it cooled down. So I said, okay, well, I'll tell you what I'll do. So we kept trying to get, I said, what if I get some good speed up and turn it off there, but glide in, okay? And so we'll do it. So I'll be able to deliver it without it, because when you turn off it, you go, very noisy. So we tried it about 6 or 7 times. Didn't get it right. Finally, this man, who I later realised was Paul Verhoeven, came out of his room. He was having a stressful experience doing Total Recall. What the fuck is this noise? Why you keep driving up and down outside of my cabin and trying to write a movie here? So we apologised and left.
Wow.
It's my one meeting with Paul Verhoeven.
That's to be shouted at by Paul Verhoeven.
See,
that is a life goal.
Normally, I think you can see both sides. I think he was absolutely right.
Yeah.
Yeah. But those movies, they obviously, to an extent, inform and colour the way you make films in terms of what we see on screen. Is that kind of fun?
Well, I like what I find very satisfying and I think existed more in the past than it does now, is a really high quality commercial mass market movie with a brain that's intelligently made. And you can say that about, I mean, RoboCop and Starship Troopers. Starship Troopers wasn't a massive success, I don't think, but RoboCop was a huge smash, and it's a really smart political film.
Yeah.
But it's also kind of trashy and gory and sensational and enjoyable.
I mean, it's not subtle. The message isn't subtle.
No, but isn't that a lovely combination of sort of junk and quality?
Yeah.
You could say the same about Raiders, about Die Hard. There's just culturally, I don't know, there was an intelligence to pop culture. Pop culture's a bit more craven now.
I think we're getting some of the films, though. Don't you think Guardians of the Galaxy and Black Panther, those films, they had that?
They're pretty good.
Of...
I don't think, if I may be so bold, that they have the thematic intelligence that those particular movies did.
I would concede.
They're wittily done. They're brilliantly made. They're extremely enjoyable. But as kind of moments in the zeitgeist, I would put something like RoboCop ahead just because of what it's saying about society without sacrificing the joy of it.
Well, it's interesting that obviously this brings us back to The Kid Who Would Be King, because you are saying something about society in a not overly specific way. It's not about Trump, it's not about Brexit per se, but it is about the chaos in the world and the disorganisation and the kind of lack of leadership that we have today, and the lack of a kind, I guess, people with a moral compass in charge. Mm. That was unexpected because I knew you'd been working on this movie for a while, but it dovetails so neatly with the world today. So presumably when you were writing this as a kid, that wasn't the intention, or was it?
Well, weirdly, if you were a kid in the early 80s, and you went into central London, there'd be bomb threats from the IRA on the underground and in central London. You'd turn on the TV and see Two Tribes by Frankie Goes to Hollywood, talking about nuclear Armageddon or When the Wind Blows by Raymond Briggs. There was Thatcherism, there were strikes. What else? There was all sorts of...
Reagan was in power,
There was all sorts of... When you're a kid, as much as you try and bury your head in toys and games... Little bits of what's happening in the adult world seep through, don't they?
Not in my world, as you can tell from where we're sitting right now. But yes, you're absolutely right. So I guess it was. So there was a feeling even then that you wanted your version, this modern retake on the Arthurian legend, to be relevant to society.
Well, it also, the legend of King Arthur is an overtly, it's Britain's creation myth, right? So it's got stuff to say about society. And the original story is about this king that rises when Britain is divided and all the tribes of Britain are
and how he wins over his enemies.
How he turns his enemies into allies. It's also about the chivalric code, which is a code of moral behaviour. So that's inherent in the story. And I think everybody who's done King Arthur usually deals with that in one respect or another. But weirdly, those themes are strangely pertinent now. I mean, unavoidably, really, aren't they?
The studios were happy with this because you made it with Fox, didn't you? You made it with Working Title in the UK.
Yeah, they were fantastic. I had an incredibly good experience with Fox. They gave really smart notes and they were incredibly supportive.
You have a bridler when they say, for example, and I don't know if happened this film, when they say, we need more explanation there. I need you to ADR a line in saying, but we're going there because of this. You know, you get that quite a lot from studios, I believe. Did you encounter that?
Well, we did that ourselves because when you test screen a movie to an audience, often you have to put little extra bits of ADR in because the effects aren't there.
Yeah.
And the audience will get lost. So they didn't. They didn't actually give me those.
But you were
notes
happy with that. I just remembered the other joke that I really liked. There were a couple of jokes I really liked in it. One was I don't want to spoil it for people. I hope everyone will go and see it. It's great fun. And also, we must support films which are trying to do something new on this scale. Otherwise, everyone moans and says, why aren't movies like this made? Scott Pilgrim came out, didn't do anywhere near as well as it should have done, even though everyone I know who saw it adored it. And it just didn't get supported. So please support this film. Make sure you go and see it at least once. But there's the round table joke, which I loved. And there's the joke when, without wanting to give it away, someone reappears in a car.
Yes.
Some people in a car, and that's a wonderful moment. And I got the feeling maybe that was the whole driving purpose of people, one of the main reasons why adults have to disappear at certain times, so you can put that joke in.
Yeah, there's a kind of thing where anyone who hasn't been knighted by the sword disappears when the baddies appear. But no, that was just something that occurred to me while I was writing.
A very funny moment.
Oh, good. Thank you.
I really laughed out loud, and for longer than anyone else in the cinema.
Was there anyone else in the cinema?
Yes, I was with, well, it was a preview screening. So, yeah, there were a bunch of people and everyone enjoyed it.
Who else was there?
David Walliams was there.
Yes.
He enjoyed it.
He wrote me a lovely email this morning that made me feel very happy.
And then the rest of it was my family, all of whom enjoyed it.
Which is a lot of people.
It's as many as one would wish at a screening. It didn't feel empty. I almost hesitate to ask this because it's probably going to be, what, another 10 years? But what 15. Is next for you?
I've got a bunch of things I'm working on. I've got a kind of fun horror thing I really want to do.
So comedy horror, when you say fun horror, or just it's fun for you to work on?
I have a theory that all popular movies have comedy in them. All good movies have, I mean, obviously there's some like very serious art stuff that doesn't have comedy in it.
Schindler's List wasn't big on laughs.
No, you're right, and that's a great movie. Comedy just means enjoyable to me.
Yeah, you're right. We were mentioning Nolan, even in Inception there were some moments of humor.
The Shining is a terrifying film. It's got some really funny bits in it. Like, comedy is just shorthand for enjoyable.
Yeah.
So hopefully it'll be an enjoyable horror film rather than a grim torture porn.
Yeah, as I get older as well, I find that less watchable. I found myself less willing and less able to sit through stuff which just has people being hurt for what, silly
pop-pop. I do think that is the common denominator in all the films we've talked about liking in this conversation, is that they're fun.
Yeah.
You know, reading about Die Hard was interesting. Because I was doing a thing about it and I was reading about it. And one of the things that John McTiernan said is the story was originally about terrorists. And he said, look, no one wants to see a film about terrorists. They're evil, dark, horrible people. Let's turn them into criminal robbers using terrorism as a cover. Mm. And let's make it fun. So all their work on Die Hard was to make it entertaining.
Did you enjoy Get Out, speaking of horror films?
I like Get Out very much, Yeah. It was great.
I can't wait to see the next one from him.
Yeah, that looks really good, doesn't it?
But of course, I can't wait to see the next one from you.
Well, thank you very much. Hopefully it won't take as long.
And so you finished the script for this horror film?
We finished a few drafts. I've got a little bit of polishing to do.
What's the right working title?
I can't tell you.
Why not?
I'll tell you once the recorder's off.
Does it give too much away?
Because it's actually inspired by stuff that we've done together, holidays we've been on in the past.
Japanese. It'll be something that's set in Japan, clearly.
No.
I know, we went to Florida together, didn't we?
Yeah.
Okay.
All right. But who knows if that is what will happen.
Yeah.
You know, I feel hopefully I've got enough experience under my belt to, handle anything.
Well, I'm thrilled by this. And once again, you know, I was surprised at how good Attack the Block is. And I don't mean that in a negative way.
Surprising.
It felt so confident and it was so kind of fresh and it was so quintessentially British as well, in a way, the setting and the way you told the story, which of course you could not really set The Kid Who Would Be King anywhere else because of the Arthurian legend. Is there pressure on you to try and make, from the studios, to try and make it more American, more global in that way?
Not at all, no. I mean, the other period I loved growing up was the whole Palace Pictures era with Steve Woolley and Nick Powell and Neil Jordan and movies that weren't necessarily massively successful but were brilliantly ambitious and creative, like Company of Wolves and Absolute Beginners.
And Mona Lisa.
Mona Lisa, yeah. The directors like Alan Parker, like, I felt really proud as a film goer in the 80s of the British industry and all those directors, especially when they made British films. like celebrating our pop culture on an international stage.
And seeing Bob Hoskins, who I know you refer to as Bobo.
Bobo.
And I told you,
the late, great Bobo.
You and Adam used to refer to Bob Hoskins as Bobo. And I think Adam used to do the voice, didn't he, of Bobo?
Yeah, well, he does better voices. We both would do the voice. He'd do it better than me.
You know, I met Bob Hoskins many times, and I remember telling him, I said, oh, these friends of mine, they do a thing where they refer to you as Bobo.
Bobo.
And he looked at me quite angrily.
Insulted, yeah. Ooga booga. It's my all-time favourite Bob Hoskins line when he... gets kicked out of the club in Roger Rabbit by the bouncer gorilla.
Do you remember these TV series he did about adult literacy?
No.
There were TV information films. It was called, I'm trying to remember what it's called, but it was basically he was a man who couldn't read.
Right.
And was obviously a little embarrassed about this, but it was like a saying, it was an advert, it was a public service broadcasting saying, you probably can't read. And in which case, look, here's Bobo. He can't read. It's okay.
Did it say here's Bobo?
No, sadly not. I've reimagined something. It's worth checking out. I think it was called On the Move.
I do remember On the Move. It had a little song, On the Move.
Move, On the Move. Yeah. Maybe I've made that part up. I know, so maybe I've conflated.
We did a song about Bobo Hoskins that included a kind of rap, Roger Me Rabbit, Ragged Me Rawny, Mona Me Lisa, Blew Me Ice, or something like that.
Oh, tingle me fancy, have a banana, what a palaver, oval a bush, apples and pears, scruffle me nuts, I'm off to step me to waggle me brush, long me good Friday, ragger me rawny, roger me rabbit, moaner me leaser, mer me maids, blew me ice, smack me behind for just two or six.
And the film critic Jason Solomons, who was a fan of our stuff, obviously knew that song, because when he went on the radio and did Bob Hoskins' obituary, he read his filmography out in precisely that order and very nearly slipped into song when he said it.
Joe, lovely talking to you. I can't wait to see your next movie, but I'm going to go and see this one again, and I'm going to pay this time just so I can support British films
God
and your
you.
Films
Thank
in particular.
Thank you, Jonathan.
Great to have you.
Thanks for having me.
You have to see what I found. There's something written on the card. Put it into Google Translate.
It means Sword of Arthur.
What if it's the sword in the stone?
So The Kid Who Would Be King is out on the 15th of February all over the UK. Make sure you go and see it. A, it's a great film. It's very, very funny, amazing special effects. And the fact that it's not based on some existing franchise, the fact that it's fresh and it's an original film trying to appeal to a broad audience, that's surely got to be applauded and supported. So please, 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 don't pirate it. Don't wait for it to come on TV. Don't wait for it on one of your streaming services. Go and see it at the cinema, which, by the way, is where it deserves to be seen because it's quite sumptuous to look at as well. Thanks for listening. If you haven't already subscribed, please do so, which means we'll make more of these for you. Next week, I'll be talking to someone else.